Oh, hey, what is up, everybody out there? We're back again here with we got a really good episode for you tonight, Mike Merlu. But if you guys are, if you're just tuning in, that's Mike.
Yeah, that's me. Scott, why do you act shocked that the episode starts? You're like, what's this? Oh. You came here for entertainment.
All right, fine, fine. Well, let's rewind. Okay, the music started. The bagpipes coming. All right, go ahead, bro. We'll go.
Yeah, baby. I know you came back for me, and you're welcome. Because here's Mike, now the host of this show known as Verbal Shenanigans. There's my co-host over in Jersey. Scott, how are you doing this evening?
So you went with like the Joe Biden approach. Yeah, baby, you know you want me, and that's okay. Like yeah. you went for the creepy Joe Biden approach, and that's okay with you.
Yeah, I'm going outside after this interview. I'm going to caress some girls' hair, and then I'm going to tell people I'm still better than Trump, and then head back into the house and stay here for the next 6 months and hope they forget about what I just did.
So 292 episodes in, you do an intro, and your first intro was, "Hey, baby, I know you want me. Welcome to the show."
Yeah, I mean, I was going to cute and short and sweet and to the point, but I said, you know what, that's not my style. They know who they're dealing with.
So all this time that you know that part of the show gives me anxiety, that first minute and a half is the hardest part for me to podcast. Once we get into like whatever we're talking about, I feel comfortable, I feel golden to our audience. But you, all this time, you leave me out there on a limb by myself, out on the plank. And you just watch me, and you watch me struggle. And you've had this built up for 6 years, Berlu? You've had this built up for 6 years in your brain.
Listen, everybody knows Verbal Shenanigans is a multi-million dollar conglomerate. Correct. And we run this like a business. And we have at least 4 to 5 meetings every day on preparing for each podcast.
Right.
At no point when we go through the daily minutes and I go, okay, before we adjourn, any other things to bring up, there's Scotty Brennan trying to get ready for his lunch break. He's there with his Superman thermos and his PB&J that he got from his mommy with the crust is cut off. You're just ready to go to the cafeteria because we own a building, as everybody knows. But no, you don't stick around and say, oh, Mike, I think I'm having some issues with how to open this week's show.
Okay.
No, you just go on about your business. And now that the master has taught you, I hope you will be prepared for episode 293.
No. I hope you will be prepared for episode 293 as you do the intro for 293, which we happen to be recording right after this. So you better step your game up immediately. You wished for it, and now you receive. Be careful what you wish for is the motto, Berlu.
I mean, I feel okay because we'll have to do like a 5-minute outro after this, so I feel that's going to give me enough time to come up with something clever.
Okay.
I mean, I feel that way. I'm usually wrong, but I feel that way.
Well, anyways, if you're just tuning in, we are a weekly podcast. Twice a week lately. Because of a pandemic season, if you will. And we've been putting out things twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays for the most part. And we got a great episode for you today, but we're going to jump right in it because today we did an interview, really, really, really great interview with Larry Hankin. And it went pretty long, so we don't waste your time with us talking. We want to jump right into Larry here. Larry Hankin, you might know him from Breaking Bad, Home Alone, Escape from Alcatraz, Seinfeld, Billy Friends. Madison. What was that?
Friends.
And he's a guy, like, you might not know his name, like, oh, immediately, but as soon as you see his face, you're like, oh my God, I know that guy. He's been in like a million different things. And Larry goes into all sorts of great stuff here on the show tonight. He goes into acting and the way his brain works and some of his disadvantages and the way his memory goes. So Larry was a really cool guest, so I just want to jump right into it. So me and Mike don't waste our time. We'll argue off the air about our intros and whatnot. So Mike will go prepare, and I will finally take a shift off. But without further ado, here is Larry Hankin. Larry, I want to first off, before we get this going, I do want to thank you for giving us the second amount of time here. I explained to the listeners before, but right after your interview, we were talking about the interview, we were having a good time, all of a sudden, boom, power outage, and the file that was recording live just gone. It was as if it never happened.
And that's cool.
We were bummed out. We were depressed. I said, I'll call Larry the next day, and you graciously gave us the time again. So first, I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, but what I said on the last program was gems that will, lightning in a bottle that will never be recaptured. So,
all right.
Darn. Well, okay, so let's start all over again.
All right, well, let me just call my co-host here. We're going to merge him in.
You.
All right, Larry, you should be able to hear Mike. Mike, you should be able to hear Larry.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Mike? Yep, we're back.
So, okay, yeah, cool.
So, Larry, one of the things that I found fascinating about when we talked was you explained kind of your take on, your work and kind of how you work, how it's both, it's given you setbacks, but it's also kind of made you kind of who you are and the type of actor you are. And he explained kind of your dyslexia and what you struggle with and whatnot. I would love to get into that again because it's absolutely fascinating. So when did you first know that there was an issue that might have been either holding you back or you weren't like recognizing things the way, aka, you should have?
Well, since I was born with it, I just got to say one thing that between the last time we talked and now, I heard an interview with the guy who played Fonzie,
Henry Winkler.
Henry Winkler. Yesterday, as a matter of fact, and he has dyslexia also, and he was being interviewed about that for about 5 minutes on that particular subject.
Really?
And it opened my mind to a lot of things that I started to recognize, because I've only in my lifetime have ever heard two other people, and Henry was one of them, talk about dyslexia or having it. So I've never actually met anybody or heard anybody talk about it, although I know either between one out of five or one out of seven people, at least in the United States, if not in the world, are dyslexic. They just don't know it. And I didn't know it until I was around 30 or 35. The reason I didn't know it was because back when I was born, there was no such thing as dyslexia. That term hadn't been invented yet. Anybody who had dyslexia when they were born, including me and including Henry Winkler, because he told me, he told the interviewer, stories about his parents. When you're born with dyslexia back in the day, and I'm talking about back in the day, this is before, say, 1970. So it's a very current term and a very current discovery of this is different. We were all known as stupid. I was called stupid by my father. I mean, which when I went to a therapist about, why I wasn't functioning correctly, he asked me about that. He said, yeah, well, my dad used to call me stupid. And he was just blown away. He said, you have no idea how much damage parents do to their kids. And he also was a therapist for children, which I was kind of insulted that, because I went to a clinic and they assigned you.
Right.
To therapists.
Okay.
So I went to a clinic and he said, the guy who was interviewing me said, do you have any preferences for? I said, yeah, well, you. I'm getting along with you. We've been talking here for about a half an hour. He said, well, no, I can't do that. That would be against the rules because I would be then trying to get people to be with me. So, no, you can't pick me. But anybody else. So he said, I'll just assign you to somebody. And he assigned me to a child psychiatrist. And I was very insulted, but the guy was great. And I didn't discover that until I saw a child being in the waiting room. You know, you, there's not a waiting room in therapy. You just come at your time. And generally, maybe you see somebody just walking out of the office. Although he was kind of cool. He had another door you could go out. So you never saw anybody coming in. You know, you never met, any of his customers, his any clients. So he didn't even say that I was dyslexic. He said that I needed to focus a lot more and that I was distracted. And he picked up those kind of things, told me a lot of other good stuff. So that was the first kind of hint to myself, geez, I should get help. That was around when I was 30. I was circled around or centered around the fact that I couldn't remember lines very well, and that the better parts I was getting and the bigger parts I was getting, the more difficult it was for me to memorize all the lines, and I would have to get my scripts as part of the contract to send me the script as early as possible. I was one of the first people who would ever get a finished script. And then when I started to get parts in movies where I saw that the part was so huge in memorization that I turned it down. I started turning down parts because I knew I would have to, like if the part was 3 days, it would take me maybe a week to memorize 3 days worth of shooting. So I started to withdraw, and now I'm not a person who takes, I kind of make lemon, I make lemons out of lemonade is what I do. it's a survival mechanism, right. But it works for me in that I don't take anything as a defeat. It's just I lose interest is what it is. So if I'm not doing well in anything, I'm not getting these lines down very fast, I don't think it's some sort of wound, you know, psychological wound. I take it as, well, I'm not interested in this. Let me do something else. So I guess when I started to really go up on my lines and had trouble in front of the camera, that was like a signal. Okay, you're too bored with that. That's, in other words, that's how I defined it. I said, oh, well, I'm too bored with this. That's why. And it was a focus thing. That's part of my dyslexia. Everybody is just different, really. There's it has to do with the wiring in the left side of the brain, the artistic side of the brain and the right side of the brain. They get mixed up and stuff. So I just thought I was getting bored. So I would just find another outlet for my energy, for my creative forces, whatever that was. So I started to make, and I had enough money saved up by, I guess it was just 35 or around 35. I started to make my own film shorts. So I was plugging it into that, the creative forces. So, you know, it was new. It was fascinating. I was really focused on it because I really was interested in doing it very much. And I could memorize my lines that I wrote for myself in my film shorts much faster than I could with people who hired me to memorize lines. So it was a kind of a good thing because I was making a lot of money for other people being in their movies. And I thought, well, eventually I'm going to make my own movie. So this is a good thing. So I kept on looking at it that way. And even Henry Winkler mentioned that he had a terrible trouble memorizing lines, but he stuck with it in that he would really, he had the willpower to just stick with it, I guess because he had no other interests. I had other interests like painting, art other things that I could just go to and just drop this and go to that, you know, but he didn't. So he stuck with it. But he was called stupid by his family too. He was called a dumb dog. Nice. He comes from German parents, so they called him a dumb hunt. But you know, that can screw up a kid really badly, you know. So that's kind of, and then dyslexia came into the lexicon, if I can make a stupid pun. I became aware, oh, I'm dyslexic. Oh, I get it. So that, I didn't want to go back to acting. The thing that really got me out of the acting business, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I was working on Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad was what pushed me over the edge.
Yes.
And I guess I got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. One was I started going up on my lines with Bryan Cranston, which I found out from the director. Well, all actors go up on lines. You're not doing anything different, Larry.
Now, when you say go up on lines, what does that mean to the average Joe?
Oh, okay. Well, it just means you forget your lines.
Right.
I don't know why they don't say, well, I just forgot my lines. Well, I went up on my lines. I don't know.
It makes it sound like a lot fancier. You know? It makes it sound a lot
fancier. Yeah, it sounds like, you know, hey, I'm really a pro, man. Mm-hmm. You know, I go up on my lines. You forget your lines.
Yeah, yeah.
I go up on my lines. So so he explained that to me, but it really hurt me that Bryan Cranston would call me on it. Nobody ever called me on it because actors do go up on their lines. They just say, okay, let's just do it again. I mean, it's part of the business. It's part of memorization is forgetting your lines. But Bryan called me on it, you know, in the middle of the scene. He said, hey, Larry, why don't you just memorize your lines? Focus. Come on. But he was trying to be Walter White. And he was, you know, he was probably part of being producing. He was thinking of money and, you know, time and we're losing the light. But the next time I dealt with Vince Gilligan, I think it was the same day, the same shoot or the next shoot. I was on three things with Breaking Bad, two episodes and yes. One the feature. I was presented when I got it was a very short little scene that I was presented with and a little five lines and you know I can memorize that. It's just when you get past a paragraph, it's burdensome. So I just memorized the five lines. I go in, and when I got there, they handed me a monologue, an entire page monologue. And it just blew me. I mean, I lost it. I really did. When the, what do you call it? The AD, the assistant director, which generally, and as far as I know in my experience, They're in their 20s. They're young, you know, kind of getting their bones by just hanging around and running errands for the director. But he hangs out with the director, and he also gets the actors set up. And I just blew up in front of him. I said, I can't do this. What do you mean? You're supposed to give me these things ahead of time and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And he just backed out. He just said, hey, man, I got to go. He thought it was nuts, which I guess I was, you know.
Now, Larry,
he just said, hey, I got to leave.
When you do see those lines and you are someone who struggles with that, is it like a seeing red kind of thing with anger, or is it pure panic that you're dealing
with?
It's
panic. Okay. It's uncontrollable. What the hell? You know, I still have vestiges of it. I was trying to get on Zoom with people now are calling on Zoom because they can't go out, so they're meeting on the internet.
Yep.
So, so a couple of my friends said, hey, we'll get on Zoom. And the person who set it up, it was only going to be four or five of us, that was all. But the person who set it up really didn't set it up badly. I've been on it, but I've never set it up. I always, the other person sets the whole thing up, and I just dial in and boom, and we're gone. We're on it. But no, this, so I had to do some stuff and the panic started to set in. I had to hang up. I had to get off the line. Huh. Either it's already set up for me or you have to give me instructions or I got a big thing coming up Saturday, but we're having a test on Friday. See, so that, and generally that's what happens. You know, if it's going to be too complex, we set it up in front. So I just had this panic attack yesterday over just getting onto Zoom. Hmm. So it's not gone. It's this a surprise. If I know in front, I'm cool. But this was a surprise because I thought, oh, this is just like another interview. It's just with friends.
Yeah.
But no, it wasn't. It was too complex. And so I had to back off.
Okay.
I mean, I didn't go crazy in front of everybody. I just said, look, man, I can't handle it. I got to get off. We'll do this next week.
I think that's very common with people who suffer from, I guess, anxiety, if you will, about the, like a lot of times it's going on internally, and a lot of people around them have no idea that there's something
exactly
wrong.
You know what I mean? Exactly, because I thought I was nuts for many years.
Right.
I mean, not nuts in the crazy uncontrollable, in that there was something wrong with me that only I knew about.
Well, I will say so personally, like my wife deals with anxiety here and there, and there's been many times where I'm like, what's the matter? What's the matter? And that's almost like the worst thing. Over the years, it's taken time to learn this, but when I'm saying, what's the matter? You don't, you okay? You okay? It's almost more of like, you know, she's dealing with this plus that on top of what's going on, you know, with her.
Right.
I've learned a lot.
Well, there's two things that do it. I mean, if you have even a touch of dyslexia, see, I am dyslexic. I'm pretty much a serious dyslexic. When I say serious, it's, I guess if you take the average, I'm right in the middle, you know. Okay. I'm like the prototype of dyslexia. But I'm also the prototype of ADHD. So the combination is really, let's say, far out. It's weird. But in general, nobody will ever notice it, you know. Yeah, they just don't notice it. But over my lifetime, I'm known as a weird guy, you know, because my answers are weird in that they're different. They're not kind of weird or scary weird. They're just out of the blue. How did you make that? I get a lot of this. How did you make that jump, Mac? You know, how did you get there? We were talking about this, and I asked you that question, and you went to there. Which is a great answer, but I don't see how it connected. That's just how my brain works.
Yeah.
So I accept it, but it blows a lot of people's minds to the betterment of me, because they're generally cool answers. Like in improvisation, I don't know, have you ever seen Second City or The Committee?
Yes.
Or a really good group?
Yep.
Well, a good group. Okay. Well, when they're on stage, right, that stuff is not written. Maybe it's worked on, but nobody has, anybody can say anything they want. I'm excellent at that. I was a master. I was a black belt at improv because I could make choices on stage out of nowhere that the audiences would fall down in laughter. I mean, tears. Now people say, how the hell would you, where did that answer come from that was so funny? I don't know. It was natural to me to say that. You know, you said this to me, and then I just answered you back, and boom, the audience just falls apart. That's the upside of it. The downside is mathematics and financial things, and the normal, the mathematics, the logical part of your brain.
Right.
That kind of has atrophied. So that's why the complexity of the Zoom connections yesterday, that's the other side of the brain. And I was just talking about this yesterday with somebody. Maybe it was you or somebody else. But
yeah.
I decided to take up music. One of the things I never was interested in was music. I don't even listen to music. Or I didn't. Now I do, but... So I took up a couple of years ago, I took up music. I wanted to learn the guitar. I don't know why I wanted to learn the guitar, but all of a sudden it became fascinated. I had a guitar. I had bought a guitar years ago, and I thought, okay. So I started to really, any spare time I had, I would get on the guitar. I would listen to people. I would ask musicians questions. And I started to learn how to play music, and it started to ameliorate, I don't know, my dyslexia. It started to, or started to massage the right side of my brain. Or I don't know if it's left or right, but the other side, not the artistic side. So music, and so now I'm very seriously into it. But, and there are ways of modifying dyslexia. You can't cure it. It's not, but you can have coping mechanisms, and there's certain things that modify it. Certain exercises, certain physical exercises can modify it. Music, if you get into it, learning it. Whatever your brain uses, however your brain uses to learn music, somehow it massages both sides of the brain.
Yeah.
So it starts to make new connections, which is weird because, well, it's weird about the brain.
Neural pathways.
It's plastic, man. Neural connections. Mm-hmm. Well, music does that, and good for me.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of adjust to it. But I got out of, right after I had that tiff with Bryan Cranston. We're friends. I mean, he doesn't even remember that, but it affected me very deeply about him just calling me out saying, hey man, why don't you just learn your lines? That was a major thing for me. And then when Vince Gilligan gave me this long speech, and I improvised it. I had to improvise it. I asked the AD, I said, you know, how long do I have to memorize this? When do I have to do this? He said, in 2 hours. And I tried my damnedest. I tried, and it was all legalese. It was the Winnebago season.
I was gonna say this is during the show, right?
Mm.
Not the movie, right?
Yeah, it was the show where I was trying to keep the cop,
yes,
his brother-in-law, out of the Winnebago.
Yep.
And I had to use legalese, so it was a monologue of legal terms. So it was even harder than usual. So I just I tried to remember as I couldn't, but the director kind of got into what was wrong with me, because I never told him I can't memorize this. He kept on saying, okay, you ready? Because he knew I'd only gotten 2 hours before. Sometimes actors, you know, need a little more time. I just couldn't do it. So he said, you know, you okay? Not knowing that, you know, I had traumatized myself. He just said, hey, you okay with this? And I said, yeah, sure. Because I wouldn't admit that I couldn't memorize it. And so he said, okay. And I said, well, we can break it down, do it in pieces, right? So I can memorize. I didn't tell him why. I just said, we're going to do this in pieces, right? Figuring I could, you know, memorize the pieces. And he said, no, we're going to just do a walk and talk. We're going to shoot it all at once, which totally freaked me out. But I refused to let that out. So he said, you okay with that? And I go, yeah, sure. So he got me down at the end there, and this is a monologue for a full page. And he said, okay, you ready? And he said, action. And I just walked and talked. I just, you know, a little memorization, a little improvisation, a little of this, a little of that. And I figured when I got to the end, because I was walking towards the camera, and by the time I got to the end of the speech, I would be, right by the camera. And I figured, well, by the time I get down there, it's about 50 feet of a walk, by the time I get down there, I'm going to be fired. So that calmed me down. You know, I was trying to jump ahead and calm myself by saying, okay, I can't memorize this. They're going to have to get somebody else. It's going to be a big to-do, a big kerfuffle. And at the end of it, I'm going to be fired. So let me just jump to the fired thing, and I'll be calm now. And I just was walking and talking and improvising. And when I got to the end, he just said, okay, let's just shoot it one more time, you know?
Right.
Just for coverage. He didn't mention anything. And I thought, holy cow, I memorized the whole thing and I didn't know it. No, I didn't. But he was a cool guy.
Yeah.
All he said was, go back there and do it again. I said, okay, fine. And I was thinking, well, I don't have to worry now because he's got it in the can. I had memorized it perfectly. So neither one of us was telling the other one what was going on. So I just got down the end. He says, okay, you ready, Larry? And then I had a clue about it when he said, well, first of all, the script girl came over to me. It's a script woman, but they call them a script girl. I don't get that. But anyway, the script woman came over to me. Now, when you see the script woman coming towards you, as an actor, you know, there's a line or two that you dropped or a word that you didn't say that's important. And she's coming to tell you what the word is or the sentence is, you know, so you have to say that. So I said, okay, fine. You know, if a word here, a sentence there, cool. But he's got it in the can. And she showed me, she says, I said, well, you know, what did I forget? And she showed me the part and the speech, the monologue. and every other word was circled. Every other word. It was ridiculous. So I just looked at her and I said, well, I got the gist of it, right? And she said, you know, I'm trying to, you know, still trying to cover it. I'm not admitting that right. I'm dyslexic or ADHD. And she said, well, the director wants you to say it verbatim as written. And I go, well, I don't want to let no. Okay, that's cool. Because I had all my arguments already. I said, yeah, well, let me talk to the writer. And she said very calmly, the director wrote this.
Yeah, Vince wrote this one.
Yeah. So I go, oh, okay. And then I see the director walking towards me. He says, are you okay, Larry? And I said, no, I'm fine. And he said, and then, so he walked up to me. So now he's walking 50 feet away from the camera, and he's standing next to me with the script girl. And he said, and the cinematographer who's down there with the camera, he yells over, hey, whatever his name was, you know, John, aren't you going to be here with the camera? And he says, no, I'm going to walk with my actor. And I'm just going, no, that's like, oh, man, I'm a little kid. Oh, he's going to walk with me. Oh, no, with the book open. Like, and I'm just, that was all.
Stand up what you're going through, but you don't want him to call attention.
Yeah, but I'm just cool. I'm cool. And he says, hey, you mind if I walk with you with the book open? And I go, no, I don't care. You know, because I was going to be fired. I mean, so it didn't matter to me what he was doing. I was cool. I mean, no, fine. You can do whatever you want. Because I'm going to do whatever I want or is able to do. So he goes, okay, you know, let's go and action. And I started walking and I did the same thing. I was just making it up. I was improvising, you know, keeping it kind of in the legal thing about you can't go in there, but improvising it, the whole thing. And he's walking and I just kind of looked over just out of the corner of my eye. He's about 3 feet away from me. He asked the cameraman, you know, where am I out of frame? You know, he said, well, it's about 3 feet away from me. That kind of, and he's walking and his head is in the script. He's just looking at the script, you know, listening with the ear and walking and walking and walking. And I get down to the end of the thing and I go, okay, now he's going to fire me, right? And he says, okay, thank you, Larry. That's let's move on. Next shot. And he just walked away. And I go, what the hell just happened, man? So what he did, and he's a cool guy, man. He's so cool.
I also love the idea of you thinking that, like, I hit every word on that.
I was dismissed, and I was dismissed for the day, so I just left.
Right.
So I had to wait 3 weeks. The only thing I asked was the AD when he, you know, he took me to the car to take me back to the production because we were in the middle of the desert. I said, when will this be aired? Because I wanted to see what I did, you know, and I still had the script so I could see what I was supposed to say. So he said, yeah, in 3 weeks. So I waited for 3 weeks, and then I told all my friends, well, two or three friends, I told them, would you please watch this? And I'll ask you a question about it afterwards, but just watch it. I'm on, you know, and they're, oh, yeah, well, I watch it anyway, so fine. So 3 weeks go by, and I watch it, and here's what he did. And he knew all along. He knew the minute I was in the maybe 5 feet into the first take, he knew what he was going to do, that director. And he never copped to it to me. And he never copped that I was not learning the lines. He was so cool. What he did was he took, and I'm sure Vince Gilligan did it with him. They took all the improv that I did both times, and they did a voiceover. They cobbled together from all the improv that I did enough of the legalese that I improvised that kept the cop out of the Winnebago, and they stayed off of me camera-wise. So they just only cut to me three or four times during the whole walk for maybe 3 or 4 seconds when I got a line right from the script, or else a line right that they would use in cobbling together so they could see me saying it, the audience could see me saying it. So the entire walk of 50 feet and that entire monologue, I timed it with a stopwatch. I was on screen for maybe 10 to 15 seconds.
Yeah.
The other time, yeah. The other time they went to the cop, he's listening to me, then they cut inside to them, then they went back to the cop, then they went to me for about 3 seconds, and they went back to the cop, into the Winnebago, back to the cop, into the Winnebago, back to me, 3 seconds, saying right line. Boom, boom, boom.
Yep.
Movies is magic, man. And it was just smooth. And I asked my friends, I said, what did you see? Well, you were walking and talking is legalese stuff. And they were in the Winnebago and you're talking to the cop.
The beauty of editing, man. It's amazing.
The beauty of editing and also because of the voiceover kept me present always. So that they thought I was, so I said, but how long was I on screen? I said to them, you were in scene. That was your scene.
Right.
You know, you were talking to them. So I said, no, I wasn't in the whole scene. I was in the scene for maybe 10 to 15 seconds by the clock. That's amazing.
It's awesome.
but it's also amazing. Now, so there's my dyslexia. There's where it did me good. I improvised because I was a great improviser, you know, even though I didn't know I was doing good. But there was the compliment to the director. He didn't call me on it. He didn't say a word. He just got it the first 5 feet. He go, all right, this guy's not got it. I hope he says the right wording, though. Or gives me enough stuff where I can put a voiceover. And then Vince allowed him to do that, you know. So, because he hired me after that. He hired me for the feature. So Vince, you know, thought I was cool. Yeah. So it's, movies is magic.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, it's an incredible story. I mean, kind of curious as you, like, dove into your dyslexia and everything. Like, let's go back to the beginning of your kind of story, just out of curiosity. What, like, I remember unfortunately with the interview we lost, we chatted a little bit about your days doing like stand up in Greenwich Village. Out of curiosity, is the reason you did improv and like storytelling just because it was more comfortable in your brain, or were you just not like interested in doing like a regular stand-up routine, for lack of a better term?
I was an artist and a performer all my life. I mean, even as a little kid, I would put on puppet shows, you know. Even when I was like 10 or 11, I'd put on little puppet shows for my friends. And then I would also always be drawing, always on, you know, in my books, in my school books, I would always be drawing. So those two things, and I just grew up, but I never wanted to be an actor, or I never wanted to be in show business. I studied industrial design. I was like an A student in industrial design, but I hated it. I didn't want to be a designer, but, you know, my parents, they wanted me to go to college. They wanted me to be a doctor, a lawyer, a professional. So I chose, because they didn't know about rebelling. You know, it was in the 50s, you know, so I didn't know about rebelling. And it was a very middle class, right-wing kind of family. No, you know, very anti-intelligence, anti-intellectual. No books in the house, nothing. So I just accepted it as, oh, I know nothing, and I guess everybody knows nothing, you know. Okay, cool. So, but when I went to college in industrial design, my best friend in college was Carl Gottlieb. Carl Gottlieb later went on to be one of the head writers of the Smothers Brothers show. He wrote Jaws, the movie.
Yep.
I mean, the guy's cool. He wrote all the Jaws movies, except one, the last one. He wrote a lot of movies.
That's the best one not to write, by the way.
Yeah, yes. I think that's why he said, no, I just can't do it. He now he calls it the fish movie. I mean, he has the fish movie. But he bought him a house and a lot of, you know, nice stuff. But anyway, so we graduated together, and I didn't want to be an industrial designer. I hated it. I hated it because I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle the math part. The art part is why I wanted to be in. I chose that. Was because of the art stuff. But the math and the engineering part, you know, just the drag. But I got like B pluses and A's all the way through. Because I could figure things out. And so I just quit after I graduated. So we went to Greenwich Village. We rented a place together, I think it was $75 a month. Maybe $150. My part was $75. But I just swabbed decks, duck boards and stuff in a bar from like 2 in the morning, from last call until the chef came in the morning. It was Bar and Grill at 6 in the morning. So I just – and I loved it. I loved doing it. The only thing was it wasn't enough money, but I'm glad I wasn't in industrial design. So I had a lot of time to myself. So I would go to these coffee houses because it was cheap and you could sit there for a whole evening with one cup of coffee. And it was just an open mic, you know, so they didn't check. Nobody checked. And I started to see, I was funny in high school and college. I was a funny guy. And I see these comedians get up on stage. And I say, hey, I can do that, you know. And I thought, yeah, I can do it. And it's, you know, Monday night, it's an open mic night. So I got up, dude, just for the hell of it. You know, I signed up. And I was really awful, really awful. But for some reason, I thought to myself, hey, I'm a funny guy. I won. Funniest in high school 2 years in a row. What's wrong with
the champs here?
I mean, well, you know, something is weird, and I'm not going to give in on this. I am going to be funny again. So every Monday night, and in Greenwich Village, there was not only Monday nights. There was Monday open mic night, Tuesday open mic night there, Wednesday open mic night here. So it was all over until, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday was pretty much, you know, the headliners in the coffee houses. But, you know, so I was working all of the open mic nights, and I was really bad. And I've heard some of the recordings. And they, the kindness of the open mic night audience was a blessing because they don't boo. I mean, it's an open mic night. They're not expecting anything. So they just don't laugh, which is, you know, for somebody who won 2 years in a row, funniest in high school.
Do you know who I am?
Don't you know how funny I really am?
On stage, tell them.
I mean, I'll tell you, there's only one joke, and I use this. It's not funny, so don't expect to laugh. But this is how bad I was. I went to a psychiatrist. How did that work? There was a mosquito in my room at night. You know, it's hot in New York. You know, so there was a mosquito in my room, and he was keeping me awake. So and he wouldn't leave, and I couldn't catch him. You know, I couldn't swat him. So what I did was, I decided to psychiatrize. Psychiatric. What is that called?
Psychiatrizing?
What I did was I made friends with him, put him on a couch. And when he was on the couch, I slammed the couch against the ceiling. I mean, the logic of that.
I like it.
Ridiculous.
I like it.
Well, I like it now.
I like the misdirect.
You know, because you guys laughed.
I liked the misdirect of it.
But nobody laughed. I mean, and I tried it like several times. I think I used it for a week before I gave up on it. This is funny.
Though, from open mics, if there's any new comics listening, is that open mics, the laughter doesn't really matter as much as just getting up on stage and getting it out of your mouth.
The will, yes. Because here's when I got off stage. This was the key. Because a lot of people said, well, why did you keep doing that? Because every time I got off the stage, what I would tell myself, totally with the same calm that I was telling myself to the director about, when I get to the end of the speech, I'm going to be fired. You know, that total calm zenness of, I know the future, and I am with it.
Right.
You know, and I would get off the stage and I'd say, yeah, but I can do it better next time. That's all I said to myself. I can do it better next time. I was either thinking, well, I told it wrong, I'll just make up something else. But it was very normal, not panicked at all. And here's the thing about dyslexia and here's the thing about ADHD. That's the upside of ADHD. Not many people know this except first responders and psychiatrists. If you're going to be in trouble, like if your house is ablaze, I mean, all of a sudden in the middle of the night, your house is ablaze, you want to go, you want to follow the dyslexic. You want to follow the ADH person. Mm. Now, why? Why is that? Because basically ADHD is like, you know, when they give Adderall to young kids, because they're, you know, they're always jumping around and excited all the time, too much energy. So they want to calm down little kids. So they give them Adderall, which is kind of like a speed thing. It's almost like cocaine. It's not cocaine, but it's like some drug like that. But because he said, well, why are you giving an upper to a kid who's got too much energy? You want to calm him down. The theory of the reason that it works is, no, the mind is going to, one part of your mind is going faster than the other. So either the drug speeds up the part that's too slow, so you're now even, so you're cool, or it does the reverse. It's so much energy that the temperature goes down, the speed of your natural speed goes down. So anyway, in an emergency, somebody who has ADHD, that's like Adderall to a kid. In other words, an emergency, they become very calm. I've done it 3 or 4 times in my lifetime where an emergency came and I was the only cool head and I didn't know why. A kid, while I was at somebody's house, somebody did an 18-year-old, or maybe, 18 or 17-year-old, had done too much marijuana, and he was woozy. And he came into the room, I guess he was smoking in the bedroom or something like that, of this private house, it's just somebody's house. And he came out, and he was woozy, and we were all looking at him like, what the hell? And he was woozy, and he walked into a picture window, and he went head first, fainted, into the picture window, landed, and he slashed the side of his head, the glass of the picture window, cut the side of his head from kind of the middle of the head down to his ear. And he was just like gushing blood. I mean, it was just, it's pouring out of him. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, hey, call a doctor. It was like, holy. And I just, and everybody started screaming and running around and going, call 911 or get on the phone or blah, blah, blah. And I just very calmly, they just described this to me. And I didn't know, I just go, oh, I know what to do. And I just walked over to him. I picked up his head. I knelt beside him. And I just took my whole hand and I pressed hard on the open wound. I had to use my other hand to hold his head so that I couldn't push his head to the side. In other words, what I was doing, I was squeezing his head. That's what I was doing. Squeezing his head with both hands. But one hand was shutting down the blood from pouring out of his head. Jeez. And I said, tell me when the emergency guy comes. I got to be here now. You know, just I had to sit with the kid crushing his head. And he was just staring into my eyes, you know. And I just went in about, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, whatever minutes, however, when the guy came, he said, holy cow, you know, okay, let go. And then he got in and did that. And then he taped him up and stuff like that. And as he left, he said, man, you know, you saved this kid's life. He would have been dead by the time we come here. Jeez. Now, I had no idea why I did that, but that's ADHD.
Right.
That's ADHD. And I've done it once or twice. I was a lifeguard, and I've done it where the emergency, you don't have time to think. It's faster than thinking. It's just reacting. It's like basketball. You don't think. You react on the court. Talking pro ball. No thinking on the court. You react.
That's awesome.
And I just did that. And I remember the kid, the kid's father. I was walking down the street one day, and this kid came up, this kid and a father came up to me, and he said, I don't know how he even knew me. I was just walking in the area. I mean, it was a neighborhood thing. He came up to me, said, you're the kid. I was about 20, I think. He said, you're the person who saved my son. I said, well, what did I do? He said, you were the one when he fell. He said, he fell through the window and he cut his head. And it was about about 2 months later. He said, and you stopped the bleeding. I go, oh, yeah. He said, you know, you saved my son's life. Oh, wow. I'm glad I did that. And he was standing. The kid was there. He said, thank you. I said, you're fine, man. And then he just walked on, and I walked on. So, I mean, that's the other thing about ADHD and dyslexia. I mean, there's a lot of downside to ADHD, but there is upsides, and I just choose to go with the upsides, you know. No. I mean, but it's a big thing now in America. They're discovering how many people are dyslexic. Well, and if you don't know it, it's really hard. You were thought of as stupid. And if you start to believe that, you're effed for the rest of your life, because that's a hard tape to get out. It took me years and learning the guitar to get that out of my head, that I was somehow wounded or stupid or...
Now,
it's not fun.
Do you try to do anything? Like, it seems like you're acquiring knowledge even, you know, now in your life on kind of your disability. Do you do anything to try to, like, help, like... or even like give input to like young actors or young artists who are dealing with the same kind of thing?
No, because everybody's different. Right. And it would be like, you know, there's a lot of home remedies that cure things to this day.
Right.
A lot of things that my mom taught me, you know, about putting salt, gargling with salt for a sore throat. That's not a doctor didn't tell me that.
Yeah.
That's my mom told me that, you know, but it works. And if you talk to a doctor, you say, yeah, that works.
Now, I'm curious to what you would think as far as right before this interview, we started at 7:30. I did a digital comedy show for a company where we did the Zoom, but we did comedy over the show. And, of course, it's awkward to begin with. What is your thoughts on that as far as like during this pandemic, like comics trying to at least do some sort of comedy? Would you be like okay with that, or would that complete?
I've already started. You got to get over that,
right?
I mean, as a comedian, if you want to make somebody laugh, you know, is there too soon? You know that thing?
Yeah.
Oh, too soon.
It's the worst.
You know, well, no, it's not too soon for me.
Yep.
It's too soon for you. So you know, but it's not too soon for me. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not too soon on anything. You know. But it may be you say something and it's too soon for me. But so that's, you know, that's bull. But I've already started on the COVID thing. I mean, already I've got like an angle. See, first you have to get an angle, an approach. You can't just start telling jokes, because with me, you have to have something to say.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, here's the difference. Adam Sandler, I he's not funny to me. He is king of comedy in Hollywood. He's king of comedy probably in the world. He's a funny guy. He's not funny to me. As an actor, as a straight actor, have you seen Uncut Gems?
I've not seen it yet.
I've seen Punch Drunk Love. Yep. I know that.
Punch Drunk Love. I was the other one. He's a great actor.
I heard.
I don't. Yes, he is. I hope I'm as good as him as an actor. But he doesn't make me laugh at all. He's not funny. It's poop jokes. It's, you know, 13-year-old stuff. I don't laugh at stuff like that. He has nothing to say. You know, he has nothing to say to me. But, you know, there's folk singers, and then there's folk singers that have something to say, you know.
Right.
Like Bob Dylan has something to say. You know, okay, that's cool. He's a folk singer. Yeah, but, you know, well, he's beyond that now. But okay, so that's the difference. So, with the COVID thing, here's the upside of COVID. You know, what's the upside of the COVID thing? The upside of the COVID thing, it's just teaching us that we're not Homo sapiens and everybody else's species. No, it's teaching we're species, man. It's the first time that anything is told the entire world. You're no different than a tiger or an elephant or a dodo bird. They're species, and they come and they go. And we're a species, and we may come, and we may go. You know, it may not be funny, but it's saying something. It's the upside of COVID. It's you stop thinking about, oh, we're Homo sapiens, and a cat is a species. No, cat's a species, we're a species. You know, and all that stuff that they're digging up, the anthropologists, well, someday something is going to dig us up.
What do you think about comics doing like digital shows to people? Would you do that if you were like a comic these like early?
I don't understand. What's a digital show?
So like basically like the Zoom that we were talking about before, where you could
see. Oh yeah, man.
Yeah, I mean it was interesting.
Here's the difference.
Right.
The reason I wasn't funny when I got up on stage for opening mic nights was. it took me a while, a couple of months. I mean, and then I was opening for Woody Allen and Miles Davis, so I got it.
Yeah.
But finally, because I found out the difference, no, this isn't high school. In high school, you know, we're just talking in the schoolyard, you know, like me and Julio. We're just talking in the schoolyard.
Right.
But when you get up on stage, that's not the schoolyard. You're not talking to your friends. You're talking to strangers who paid money. Yep. Even if it's for a cup of coffee, they're here to be entertained. They're not having, you know, they're not just taking a break, you know, and eating, you know, Cheese Whiz or, you know, what else. So until I learned that this is not high school conversation, there's a format to it and a form to it. And once I got the rhythm of it and the hook of it and the da 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 da, the rhythm of it. Then I started to become funny again, but in a whole new venue. So if you want me to do digital, yeah, but I got to get the hang of it. And then when I get the rhythm of digital, like with you guys, before when I first started doing podcasts, the reason I started doing podcasts was because of El Camino. They and my publishers said, "Hey, you got to do podcasts. You know, you got to. You're a member of the cast. You got to, you know, advertise." So in the beginning, my podcasts were, you know, duh, I don't, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I started to get, oh, I get it. These are podcasts. You're not talking to anybody. You're talking to your hand. You know, talk to the hand. You know, talk to the hand. Well, yeah. My hand just happens to be my iPhone. I'm not talking to you.
That's
talking,
true.
You know,
that's
but
true.
I'm hearing in my ear, I'm talking to you.
Right.
But I got to look at my hand and my iPhone.
Interesting. Yeah.
So there's a way to do it. And until you learn the way, you're not going to be funny, or you're not going to be serious, or you're not going to be an artist, or you're not going to be a plumber, or you're not going to be, you know, a surgeon. Until you get the way and the rhythm of it.
Well, it's funny.
The rocking of it.
This was the second one I did. I did one about 3 weeks ago, and it was, you know, there's of course a little awkwardness and a little bit of latency and you know stuff like that, but
that's natural. That's
but normal. The people there, they were involved, they were having fun, they you know, like they were very appreciative of the comics doing the work and kind of throwing it out there. They were very good, I gotta say.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, I used to read a lot, and I've sloughed off in my, when I grew up, I stopped reading for some reason. I don't know. But I read a whole everything. And one of the things I read was The Green Grass of Earth. I think it was Robert Heinlein, but one of those really great science fiction guys. And one of the things that the reason that this Martian who came to Earth, the reason he liked Earth, he really loved Earth. Mars had died and they all escaped to different places and planets, and he was he escaped to Earth.
Ironically, it's going to be the opposite here.
Yes, exactly.
Earth is going to die, we're going to go to Mars.
Well, Heinlein is pretty good. That was a good story. They know a lot. Was he the reason that he liked Earth was because of the grass. Now in Mars terms, in Mars languages, he looked like an earthling, so he could pass. But he could also understand vegetation. He could talk to trees, and he could talk to grass, or he could at least understand them. And this was one of the things that he didn't understand about Earthlings, that they didn't understand everything. They only understood each other. They didn't understand animals. He was weirded out by that. And the thing about the grass was that humans never understood was grass grew to be walked on. And so if you trod on grass, that was, they were there for, you were fulfilling their legacy. And he knew
I like that.
And he called that the understanding that grass was made to be laid down on and to be friendly to human beings and to be walked on. He called that grokking grass. G-R-O, I think C-K-I-N-G, grokking. But the word grokking meant the internal natural understanding of something, not the learned thing, but the it's kind of like muscle memory in a way, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the innate understanding of, you know, if you just look at a painting and you just get it, you know, nobody explained it to you. You go, wow, man, that's so cool. That's like grokking. That's what he meant by grokking. So there's a lot of grokking going on with me and understanding things about learning new things. I guess I'm just curious. I was born curious. It's got me into terrible situations with the dyslexia. Because if I'm curious about a situation and I get myself into it, I generally grok the situation wrongly. And I've had guns pointed to my head because I said something that was cop-like in a den of thieves. And, you know, so they put a gun to my head. And they said, hey, man, I've seen this guy. This guy's a cop. And my friend who brought me in, he wanted to show me around. He wanted to show me how into the underworld he was. So he said, hey, I got a place I want to bring you to. You'll love it. He didn't tell me what it was. Basically, it was a big-time coke dealer's house. And I guess, yeah, so he said, yeah. So I walk in, and there's a party going on, you know. And we were stopped at the door, and the guy says, you know, hey, how you doing? I forgot the guy's name, John. Everybody's John. Hey, John, you know. And John says, oh, Larry, I want you to meet Bruce. Bruce, this is Larry. He's a really close friend of mine. You know, I just brought him along, you know. He's a good friend. And Bruce just looked at me like he had seen a ghost or something, and he pulled out a 45. I swear to God, man, he pulled out a 45, an Army 45. He put it to my head, and he said to John, he said, what the fuck did you do, man? You brought a cop in here. Why did you do that? And he kept on, with the gun to my head, he kept on saying to my friend, what did you do, man? What did you do? Now, that's bad. When he's, I don't know. For some reason, that way of talking to somebody thought, you know, I'm going to die. Right now, I'm going to die. Cause what did you, you know, what he basically was saying, I'm going to have to kill this guy. You stupid jerk. I'm going to have to kill this guy. That's what he was saying.
Right.
So the guy, and John is saying, no, man. He's like cool. He's really cool. He's like, No, because I have a photograph, and this is what Bruce was saying, with the gun to my head, and I was just frozen. I didn't want to move in case it moved his finger. I just was frozen, and they're having this conversation about me, and he's saying, no, man, I have a photographic memory, and I've seen this guy before, so don't tell me that this guy's not a cop. And John, for some God bless him. For some reason, he said, no, wait. Have you been to the committee? The committee was like the Second City, but we were in San Francisco. But it was the same thing. It was an improv group. It was very, very famous, big time in San Francisco.
Right.
And we were five blocks in this house, this private house. We were five blocks from the main street and the committee, just coincidentally. And he said, have you ever been to the committee? He goes, yeah. And then he looks at me and he goes, oh, man, he's in the committee. And he goes, this guy's fucking funny. He takes his underwear. He's, hey, man, dig this guy, man. Fucking from the committee. Yeah, come on in. Oh, shit.
The committee.
Holy cow, man. You know, you know, I don't know. Dyslexia, ADHD, my friend was wrong. Who knows? But things like that happen to be because of one of those three things. Either a friend takes me into a wrong place, or I have dyslexia, or I have ADHD.
Nice.
But something's weird. Yeah. And then somebody falls on a glass, cuts his head, and I got ADHD. Ooh, lucky me.
That's it.
So, you know, it comes and it goes. You know, that's my life. I'm writing a biography, so a lot of this is kind of coming to the fore because I'm thinking about it all the time. But I've had, I'll just give you the score. I won't tell you any more stories. But I've had two knives to my throat and two guns to my head. Different situations, different times. But yeah. And all because of a miscommunication somewhere.
Which was worse, the guns to the head or this interview? Which was worse for you?
Oh, this interview by far. Oh, I'm going to faint when I get up. No. It's because, you know, it's there's no, because it happens suddenly. In other words, you know, this guy's taking me to a new house. He opens the door. I see a party going on. We're standing in, you know, he takes me he takes us inside the door, closes the door, you know, so I'm inside the house and I see a party is going on. So everything is, oh, great. Oh, it's a party. So when the gun comes to my head, nobody said, now, when you walk in the door, a guy's going to pull a gun and he's going to hold it there for maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes while he discusses if he should kill you or not, or just tie you up for later and take you for a long drive. So is that okay with you, Larry? You know, no, that didn't happen. So, you know, that, well, I don't know. Do we have to go? No, that's it. But so I just froze. And I wasn't thinking of anything. There's nothing that I can remember that I was thinking except listening hard to every word that both these guys were saying. At another time, you know, different things were going on. Yeah. So I just take it in stride, and I do believe that there is an angel on my shoulder. I totally believe that, and I think one day he's going to get bored or fed up with me and leave, and then I'm on my own. And I may be on my own now.
No, that's all right.
But
wow.
From looking back, I can tell you stories that would turn my hair on end had I known it was coming, you know.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a life. It's a life.
Yeah. I mean, when you tell stories like that, I mean, I almost balk at asking you this, but is it even possible just, like, performing to go into it with fear? Because it seems like it's near impossible. Like, when we chat with you about, like, opening for Miles Davis or doing a movie with Clint Eastwood, it seems like anything I bring up will just be like, nah, that's nothing compared to what I had before this.
No, because I think, you know, when you were a kid, you fell down and you skinned your knee. If I ask you how many times did you skin your knee or how many scabs did you have, you know, do you keep count of how many times you skinned your knee or broke your arm?
I do, actually. 303 I've had. I put it on the wall.
Well, these wounds are internal. And and the memories and stuff like that. But no, because my father called me stupid all my young life. The therapy or the music or the exercises are things I've done to work around or dismiss, because I know there are tapes in there. Everybody has tapes, you know, your parents' tapes, don't do that, you know, be good, you know, be a nice person, all those tapes. And over the years, I've tried to do things to erase them or to work around them or to adjust to them, or so that's been one of my life's work, just personally, going to a therapist, going to a psychiatrist, working on my music, knowing full well and very consciously that this is psychiatry to me, this is therapy, learning music. And I'm not talking about just learning to sing, I'm talking about, you know, learning major chords, minor chords, getting into it and playing the music and playing it over again. I play my guitar every day just for therapy, you know, just for therapy. And it helps me. Now, somebody might say, that's bullshit, Larry. You know, you're helping yourself, but it has nothing to do with the music. Fine. Whatever the shoehorn is, man.
Right.
You know, come on.
Right.
You know, well, you know, don't give me that. You know, if I think it helps, but it's helping me. You know, the weird thing, I'll tell you the upside of that, is my memory is getting better. Now, as I'm getting older, you know, your immediate memory. Your short-term memory. You know, where's my keys? I lost, you know, the keys to my car. You know, that's the short-term memory. Well, as you get older and older, you know, you start losing your keys more and more. Or you know, well, what did I do with the, or where did I park the car? You know, that kind of memory. Well, as you get older and older, you get more and more of that stuff going on. It's just a bother, you know, but everybody accepts it as normal. Well, while I'm doing my therapy of, you know, for my dyslexia and my ADHD, my memory is coming back. So I'm kind of staying even at present. In other words, I'm so far behind with the memory thing because of dyslexia and the ADHD that while I'm getting older, it's even causing more of the memory to disappear. But now I'm working on my memory, so the memory's coming back. So the I lost a little today, but I gained a little today. So now I'm kind of dead even. I mean, of course, you know, you can't beat age. You know, you get older. The only thing I don't mention is the word old, O-L-D. It's a stupid word, and it doesn't apply to anything. Right. I am older than I was a couple of minutes ago.
Me too.
A couple of minutes ago.
Me too.
You know, right. Mm. But some people say they're old, and then I just look at them like that. The difference between old and older is not E-R. It's a whole different paradigm. If you say you're old, you're not thinking about age. You're thinking about debilitation. You're thinking about waning powers. You're thinking about what's coming down the road. You're thinking about death and saying, I'm old. No, you're just older. Yeah, come on. I mean, it's the whole thing with Homo sapiens and species. You know, you think you're a Homo sapien, but start thinking about yourself as a species, and you get a whole old upper-level look at the head games that Homo sapiens play. If you start thinking of yourself as a species, and you look at male-female relationships as a species, it'll blow your mind, man. Yeah, you see right. The games you're playing, the head games you're playing with the opposite sex. The stupid games you're playing. Not the real games, not the species games, but the stupid learned games you play from high school, from your parents. I mean, yeah, so, you know, it's all paradigms anyway.
Right.
You know. Mm. Well, now we're into Zen Buddhism, but that's another story.
Okay. I mean, what would you say, have you ever been starstruck in any way working with anybody or anything?
But very few people, you know, I mean, you know, like Picasso, you know, or Michelangelo. I mean, yeah, you know, I've seen Michelangelo's works in person. You know, I've seen the Pieta. I've stood in front of the Pieta. No, you can't beat that. You say, no, a human being can't do that. They can't. No way.
Right.
And not only did he do that, but like, you know, 30 or 40 other things. Plus, you know, he painted a ceiling. I mean, no, that's impossible. By the way, just to bring it down to the ground, the Sistine Chapel, you know, what the Pope did, because I studied that too. I mean, I really read a lot about Michael Angelo, and one of the things was about him that, first of all, the Pope ordered him to paint the ceilings. That wasn't like, that's a great, nice wall.
Paint the ceilings.
Permission he refused, and the Pope, and this was in front of everybody, because you know, when you go to the Pope, there's all the cardinals on one side with the red, and I mean, it's a big procession. It's like Mussolini or something. It's crazy,
right?
You know, with the production values. And he was called before the Pope, and he said, "You've got to paint the ceiling." He said, "I'm not religious." But he wasn't. So I'm not religious. So not only don't I want to do it, I can't do it. I don't believe it. So the Pope got off the throne, walked up to Michelangelo, and punched him in the face. How do you like that? Yeah, it's down in his stuff. Punched him. That's what was going on in them days. Okay, so he said, so Michelangelo read the Bible because, you know, he needed, you know, all those pictures of the Bible. He needed some input, and he was brought up as a religious, you know, kid, little child. So when you look at that ceiling up there, I'm in movies, you know, and I study directing and I study how to, you know, lay out a screenplay, and it's called the storyboard. You know what a storyboard is?
Yeah, sure do.
Yep.
Yep.
They do for every movie. You know, you do the storyboard. It's you draw the pictures. Well, Michelangelo just did the storyboard of the Bible. That's what that is.
Yeah.
That's all it is, man. If you wanted to make a movie of the Bible, you just get that, you lay it out in order, those pictures, and you got the storyboard. And you go film it.
No.
Yeah, that guy was really far out, man.
So, The last time we had you on, or the deleted interview, if you will, I was saying to you, your spread has like stretched through my film psyche or TV psyche. Like, you've basically gone for, I think Mike brought up in last interview, seven generations.
The podcast, right.
Like a movie I used to watch with my father, one of my favorite movies, Escape from Alcatraz. Then to like Seinfeld when I was a kid, Billy Madison when I was a kid, Breaking Bad, which was my favorite show of all time. So you've Home Alone when I was little. Like, you have done so much stuff and kind of transcended generations. Like, I think it's because of your perspective and how you kind of keep yourself interesting. But we have to tell the audience the story of your audition for Escape from Alcatraz. I found that story hilarious.
You mean where Don Siegel and the casting director?
Exactly. We got to tell the audience that story, because that story made me cry. That's one of my favorite movies. I think it's timeless and it's ahead of its time when it was made. You got to tell the audience the story of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have an attitude problem to begin with. I mean, it comes from everything I've just said, from the ADHD, from dyslexia, from people beating me up in high school, to just everything that's gone into me. You just develop a hard shell, you know, and the hard shell is an attitude, you know, problem. So I keep that up. That's my shield. So I get this call. I was just started down in Hollywood. So I just had an agent. I just did Laverne and Shirley. So, you know, just starting. And so he calls me up and he goes, but I did three or four. So I kind of knew the stations of the cross of auditions and how they go. And so he called me up and he said, listen, you got to go to Warner Brothers right now. What are you doing? I said, nothing. It was the middle of the afternoon. He said, well, you get down there because they're going to close in a couple of minutes. It took me an hour to get there. I lived in that Warner Brothers in the Valley, and I was in Hollywood. And
right.
So it's a long trip. He said, you got to get down there as soon as possible. They're going to close in about an hour and a half. So get down there. And I said, oh, man, okay. I hate rushing. You know, because of my dyslexia, it's just, oh, man, it's going to be another surprise. I need time to think about things. But okay, and I also was insulted because I have this thing about, I know why it's a rush. Somebody just got fired. And so they need to replace somebody right away. So get down there right away. And I'm thinking, with my attitude, I'm thinking, you know, oh, no, they didn't hire me to do the part. No, they hired me as a replacement. Well, screw them. You know. Why didn't they hire me in the first place? So that's what I'm going in with. You know, why didn't you hire me in the first place? Oh, I'm a replacement. You know, I had an ego.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Okay, I finally got, you know, pedal to the metal all the way out to the Valley. I get there to Warner Bros. And sure enough, man, there's nobody else there. You know, I was the only person probably who was home at the time, you know, to get down there in time. So I go in and then there's only an aide, some young lady, nothing to do with production at all, and one little camera, an empty room, and there's just one chair for her near the camera, and me, I have to stand there. And I said, you know, well, give me the lines. She said, what are you here for? I said, I'm here for the Escape from Alcatraz, but I don't have a side, nothing. You were supposed to give it to me. And she said, oh, yeah, here, you want time? No, I don't want, no. I was... By that time, by the time I got there, I was so PO'd with this attitude of mine that I didn't even want to go for the interview. You know, I just want to blow it off. But I'll go through with it. So she says, okay. I'll just read it. So I just read it, blah, 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 blah. And she reads it with me, and she's looking at her page, and I'm trying to memorize it and read it and to the camera and blah, blah. And she's, okay, and you want to do that? That was the other thing. She says to me, okay. And I started to walk out, and I said, do you want me to do it again? Because, I just threw it away. And I thought, well, she's going to tell me to do it again. It was just such a offhand reading of mine. And I said, do you want me to do it again? And she said, well, do you want to do it again? I go, no, do you want me to do I need to do it again? And she says, well, you don't need to do it again. If you want to do it again, you can do it again, but I don't want you to do it again. So if you want to do it again, you can do it again. Do you want to do it again? And I said, no, I don't want to do it again. Can I leave now? And she said, yes. So I left. So again, there's another thing. Oh man, I had to go through that stupid little speech. Okay, fine. I go home. The next day, I get a call, and you got the audition. You can now audition. So I go, I thought that was the audition. He says, no, now you're going to be auditioned by Don Siegel, the director. I didn't know who he was at the time. And Clint Eastwood, you're going to audition with Clint Eastwood. Wow, okay, that turned me on. Okay.
that's something.
So I go down there, and the same thing, it's an empty room. And they didn't give me and I asked my agent, I said, do they have the sides? I still don't know what I'm reading. What I read was not anything that I was assigned to read. She just had it there. It was something for me to read, not the part I was going to get if I got the part. So I get down there, and it's empty, and there's a secretary there, and she says, what are you here for? And I said, Escape from Alcatraz, is there any sides? Is there any scripts? Is there anything for me to read? She said, well, what part are you? I don't know. Nobody's told me anything. So now I'm, okay, screw Clint Eastwood. I just want to get out of here with these questions, and they don't tell me. She says, oh, well, I got a screenplay here. So she gives me the screenplay. The screenplay is 90 pages long. I can't go, So I just put it in my lap, and I go, all right, hell with this. I don't care anymore. Says, screw Clint. I don't care. So I'm sitting there, and I don't care. And this woman peeps her head out, and she says, are you ready? Are you Larry Hankin? Yes. Are you ready? Yeah, I'm ready. I'm not ready.
Right.
Yeah, I'm ready. So all right, come on in. So I come in, and there's three chairs facing each other. This empty room. I don't know what that was, like a dark empty room. I thought the walls were kind of black. I mean, it was lights. It was well lit, but I don't know. Anyway, so three chairs facing each other. And there's an elder gentleman, white hair. It was Don Siegel. And she is a, heavy duty, big time casting director, because it's a high budget tent pole Clint Eastwood movie. So, everybody is big time in there.
Right.
So I sit down. He says, oh, sit down. No, he's nice. He's a nice guy. I mean, I liked him. I didn't know who he was, except he was the director. But I thought, now somehow, yeah, even then, I didn't. I knew that he was an old time director, but I didn't know how big time he was, really. And he says, all right, well, sit down, Larry. So he says, why are you here? Again, what? I don't. But that was the feeling in my head. What? I don't know. Nobody has told me. So I'm like trying to plead my case. Now, I don't know. Nobody's given me a side. He says, you don't know what you're auditioning for? So he thought that was kind of weird himself. So he says, well, and then he turns to her. Now I'm out of the conversation. They're just talking about me right in front of me. He says, well, I don't know. What do we got open? He says to her. And she says, well, we just got two parts. We got the guard, the prison guard, and we got Charlie Butts. So he says, well, she says, what's the prison guard? He's thinking, she says, well, the prison guard has to beat up Clint Eastwood. And they're talking to us in front of me, and they're not including me in the conversation. It's like I'm not there. And she says, I don't think he can beat up Clint Eastwood. And so he turns to me, and he goes, Larry, can you beat up Clint Eastwood? And I go, no, I don't think so. He says, yeah, I don't think he can beat up Clint. No, okay, so what else you got? So he goes, well,
there's no right answer to that either. There's no right answer to that.
Yeah. So, but I didn't want to be there. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't even going to, you know, can you ride a horse? Oh, yeah. You know, and you go home and learn how to ride a horse. No, no, it wasn't even that. No, I can't beat up. I mean, I wasn't going to lie to get this job. I hated this already. So he says, all right, what else you got? She says, Charlie Butts. So he says, well, all right, how about Charlie Butts? And before I can answer, she says, no, 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 no. And she's got the script in front of her. She's open to a page. And she shows him, she points him, she says, Charlie Butts is short, he's fat, he's got freckles and red hair, and he wears glasses. So he looks at me, and he goes, and then he looks at her, and he goes, yeah, but the audience doesn't have the screenplay. So he says, what do you want to do? You want to do Charlie Butts? So I go, all right, yeah, okay, fine.
Right.
So he goes, give me the screenplay. It's to her. He says, give me the screenplay. So he gives me the screenplay. He's got his own. He says, turn to page 97. I think to this day I remember that page. He says, turn to page 97. I'll read with you. You want time? No, I don't want time. No, I'll just read it. I mean, I just, this is not going the way auditions go. So I'm like, at the end of this, I'm going to be fired. You know, it's, I'm making that adjustment. I'm not going to get this part, so I'm not going to try. It's that simple. So he goes, okay. And he reads it, blah, 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 blah. And I read it. And then he goes at the end of the page, one page. That's it. Blah, blah, blah. He says, okay, you got the part.
Right.
And then he just stares at me. And I go, what's the matter? And he goes, you don't believe me, do you? And I go, no, I don't. You know, and I'm really like getting tired of this runaround that I'm getting.
Right.
So I said, no, I don't. I mean, I just like that. No, I don't. And he goes, okay, I tell you what. Go home, sit by the phone, see what happens. Now get out of here. And I go, okay.
Right.
And I just got up and I just walked out. I didn't look back at all. I just got up and I walked out. I got home, and about 20 minutes later, I get a phone call. Hey, you got the part. Good for you, man. So I got the part of Charlie Butts. So I didn't get the script. Now, by now, at this time, I didn't have dyslexia, or it wasn't. I didn't have a big a part yet to make me wonder about my dyslexia. I could memorize everything up until that point. And Charlie Butts, if you'll remember, there's no reason why he should, didn't have many lines. He was just on camera a lot, and he was in a lot of scenes, but he hardly said anything. So dyslexia never came into the picture. Another pun. So then I went there. And, yeah, he was really cool. Don Siegel was really cool. And then I found out when I got home, I found out, you know, who he was. Holy cow. This guy's directed all the biggest stars in the world. Male stars, anyway. And I guess a lot of female stars. You know, Lee Marvin and Broderick Crawford and, you know, and Clint Eastwood. He taught Clint Eastwood how to direct. He was teaching Clint Eastwood how to direct on Escape from Alcatraz. And one day, Clint Eastwood played a doctor in one of the scenes. There's a scene with a doctor. That's Don Siegel. And Clint Eastwood directed that scene. But all the movies that insane. Don Siegel, all the movies that Clint Eastwood directed, all these great movies that he directed, that Don Siegel taught him that. And he was there. I was there. I hung around with Don Siegel, not with Clint Eastwood.
That's amazing.
I thought Don Siegel, Don Siegel was an amazing guy. Yeah.
Awesome.
Anyway, that's a story.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is.
We said on Monday we could talk to you for hours upon hours, but I wanted to make sure before we go we get into your book, the Loophole Dossier. Can you tell us a little about that?
Oh, yeah. That's on my website. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it anywhere, at any bookstore. It's on sale. You got to call or order it. But it's on sale at any bookstore that sells online or sells books. They can order it for you. Or you can order from Amazon, something in Noble, Barnes & Noble. But also my website, The Real Larry Hankin, not LarryHankin.com. Somebody stole that from me, and they won't give it to me. And they want money, and I won't pay it. So it's the real LarryHankin.com.
The real Larry Hankin.
The real LarryHankin.com. So the name of the book is the Loopholes Dossier. It's a weird title, but I thought loopholes because anyway. So what it is, it's three sections. It's three things I wrote one section a year. So that's why they're totally different. So the first section it's seven fables. There's sometimes Jones. It's a kid. It's a runaway kid who's a savant pickpocket. It's not a savant. What do you call it when you're born a genius? You're a born genius. There's a name.
Savant. Yeah.
Savant. Yeah. I guess. Well, he's a savant pickpocket. At 15, he runs away from home, and he's become famous as the best pickpocket in San Francisco at the age of 15. And so the story is about how that he picks the president's pocket, and he has a magic credit card. It's called Sometimes Jones and the Magic Credit Card. And he picks the pocket of the president of the United States through a very interesting way. And he uses that magic credit card, which gets him into all kinds of trouble and greatness, just like my ADHD and dyslexia does. You know, right. So it's kind of got that stuff in there. But it's a great little story. And then that's the first story. There's six other fables, and each one is a different age that he goes through. And then in the next one, he has a girlfriend. And then in the next one, he's married. And the next one, he gets the life insurance. And the next one, he's, I don't know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and then he becomes a Tibetan monk, and he's still like the savant. But each time he gets into trouble and you know, good and bad. What I'm saying is, it's summed up in the last story. Why you have read all these six stories.
Okay.
It's summed up in the last story.
Sounds so great.
That's the first part of the book. So Sometimes Jones stories. So Sometimes Jones. Oh, he talks to God. There's one called Sometimes Jones Talks to God. And he gets into trouble for that too. But it's also a cool thing. So there's seven stories. Okay, then the next one is it's a political story. It's a political satire about a politician who, for whatever he brings to the table, if I may use that quote, that's a political thing, whatever he brings to the table gets him nominated for the presidency of the United States. And then he gets elected, and then he gets when you're ousted from the job. He gets
fired.
Fired. Well, when the president. Yeah, but what's that? See, that's
impeached.
What? Re-impeached.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he gets elected, and then he gets impeached, and then he becomes a nobody, and then he becomes a somebody, but in a very weird way, and then he becomes success again, even in a weirder way that nobody could figure out. So that's the political satire. Nice. And all the ways in which he uses his how he looks at the world to get through or get fired or get. So it's an up and down. It's up and down and up and down. So that's the political satire. And that's what? And that's the name of it.
Right.
And, well, I'll tell you the secret of the thing. The name, the Loopholes Dossier is. That's the name of the political satire. That's the name of that section. It's called The Loopholes Dossier. And what it is from the time that he becomes nominated to become elected, when he's chosen to be the nominee, the FBI keeps a dossier on him and all other, you know, politicians who are nominated. But the dossier is continued. The FBI keeps a dossier on him until 4 years after he's impeached. So what happens when he's impeached is that dossier is slipped out to the press. So the press gets a hold of the, and his name is, I forget his first name, but something like Jonathan, his name is B.J. Loopholes. That's his name.
Okay.
So that is a kind of a tell about how he gets through things. He has a genius for the loophole of the situation. Kind of like somebody we all know. But he has a genius for that. And sometimes it gets him in trouble, and sometimes it gets him elected. So his name is B.J. Loopholes, President Loopholes. And what you are reading in this second section is the Loopholes dossier. It's the FBI dossier, the dossier that they kept. It's edited, of course, for time, only for time. But it's the dossier from the time he was nominated to time 4 years after that.
Nice.
Of Mr. B.J. Loopholes. It's a, and then the last one is kind of complex and is very serious. It is a satire, and there's very funny parts of it, but it's a serious thing. Where it comes from is when I was in New York, when I was doing the Monday night open mic nights. So it was that part of my career when I was just graduated college. I was 19, and whenever I would walk around the village during the daytime, you would see a lot of homeless people, mainly guys at the time. But they were around it. Now, every once in a while, you'd randomly see one of these guys writing in a notebook. And it was generally one of those, speckled, notebooks you get in class, those black and white speckled covered notebooks. So it was a school book, a school notebook. And they were writing in it. And I always went up to one of these guys and I would say, hey, can I read? So I was dying to see what these homeless guys were writing. I mean, a lot of them, it was around the time, pre-Reagan or, I guess it was pre-Reagan.
Right.
But, a lot of these guys were just, shipped out onto the street from the loony bins, And I've been in loony bins. They're really not loony bins. They're very serious, psychotically challenged people. I've had to get a friend out of one of these loony bins. It ain't fun, man, being there. So this, but sometimes the crazy, I don't know what we call it. They're not loony bins. I hate calling them. They're just insane asylums.
Right.
That's what they are.
Mental institutions.
So mental institutions. All right, be kind. Mental institutions. And they just, sometimes they just dump them on the streets. They're overcrowded. They just dump them. But nobody, none of those guys would ever let me read those books. And for years, I was wondering what the hell was in those books. And so I decided to write a book, and I needed another section. I thought, I'm going to write the book. Because I had already developed a character called Emmett Demas. And I had done several film shorts about Emmett Demas, who was a homeless guy. And I thought, great, I'll just change his name for this book. I'll call him Barnum Justice. So that was his name, Barnum Justice. And he was a homeless guy. And he was, because I'm in Santa Monica now. So there's a lot of homeless people around here. So what I did was I thought, okay, I got his backstory. He's a homeless guy. He lives on the beach. He washes windows and car windows and your home windows. And he cleans your glasses, whatever glass. He cleans glass. And that's how he kind of keeps himself in food, and he has a girlfriend who's homeless, and this is his book. And he carried around a digital recorder,
right,
which I have, a little pocket one, and he talks into it all the time. He's always mumbling into it. Well, he's actually talking into it very low, and then he goes home and he writes it in these books, in these school books, and he downloads them handwritten. So he has when he died on the beach, and we found his body, and his body was found by two seagulls and then two lifeguards, and then they called his girlfriend. And when they was going through his effects, they found 45 notebooks that he had kept over his lifetime of being homeless. And she gave me four of his notebooks, and which was willed to me by him. He told her, well, if I die, give these four books to Larry, because I befriended him. So that's the kind of the backstory of this Barnum Justice character. So what you're reading,
right?
So what you're reading is my typed out version of his handwritten four books. There are four books, and it's his story of what he has gone through for the last 4 years of his life. They're the last four books he wrote. So it's life is seen from the sidewalk.
That's awesome, man.
Living on... Yeah, and it's pretty funky because I was homeless for a year, so it's all true. But it's like, you know, when you get some distance... Shakespeare said, and I always kept this in mind, and that's always in front of me.
That's awesome.
It's kind of like on top of my, he said, Shakespeare said, the worst turns to laughter. That's pretty much all I remember from Shakespeare, but that's enough to keep me going until the
that's all you need.
I ain't here no more.
That's all
that's
you
all
need.
I need. That's all I needed. So basically, it's my year
right.
combined with what I've talked about. I have a lot of friends who are homeless here. Because you see them every day, you know, and you talk to them. And some have attitudes, and some are beaten, and some don't care. And some, but it's all in there. And it's called The Diary of Barnum Justice.
I love it. So everybody go out yeah. there and get Larry's book when it comes out, and go message Larry. Okay. He's fantastic. Larry, I want to thank you so much for coming on and so much for giving us the time.
Oh man, thank you.
And
thank you for having me, man, because I learn stuff when I'm talking to you guys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's why I do these podcasts. I learn about myself, you know, I learn about what's funny, but I also learn what people are interested in and stuff. So it's, you know, it's more fodder for me. So thank
absolutely.
You. Yeah, thank you.
Larry, thanks so much. Stay safe during the pandemic. Keep yourself in.
Oh,
keep
yeah.
creating. And we really appreciate
it. By the way, where are you guys? Where do you
We're in New
where
Jersey and Georgia.
Oh,
so
New
I'm
Jersey?
In Jersey and he's in Georgia.
Did I go over that out with you? I used to live in North Bergen, New Jersey. So is that near you? Or are you in the southern?
It's not far from me. I'm in Morris County, so I'm not far from there at all.
Oh, okay. I remember that name. Anyway. Okay, no, you guys stay safe. Stay safe too, okay?
Awesome, Larry. All right, the one and only Larry Hankin, Mike.
I mean, it took a lot for us to get him to start talking to us, Scott, but...
shy guy, very shy guy.
I feel we managed it. I mean, it was getting hard. I remember a lot of times we had to... yell cut, our producers be like, no, you gotta liven up, Larry. You gotta tell us something.
Right, come on, Larry. Come on.
But
get in the moment, Larry.
I mean, worst case, luckily we have a Larry Hankin imitator on staff who
right.
will fill in the gaps that he might have left in there. So we apologize that we have to go to Bruce for this week's episode.
But now you gave away what some of the stories they will hear that aren't really Larry. They're our guy.
So contest by next week, you write to Verbal Shenanigans and tell us every time you heard our imitator pop in there. And if you win, you get a t-shirt.
Correct.
And if you lose, you will get a t-shirt because we have to get rid of these freaking t-shirts.
Yeah. Like if I'm ever going to get rid of these t-shirts, you guys need to contact me and I will just send you one.
Yeah.
I will.
In fact, if you don't contact us, you're getting a t-shirt. This is going to be like the 2020 census. We need to know who's living in the house and your shirt size.
Wow. Well, guys, we're going to wrap that up. There's no need for us to keep going. So I want to thank Larry Hankin for a fantastic interview. The second time. So we really have spent like 4 hours with Larry Hankin. I feel like he's a brother of ours now.
Yeah, I feel he's now an honorary shenanigee.
Shenanigee. Wow. Anyway, Berlo, anything to promote before we get the hell out of here?
As I've been doing every week for local business promotion, I will bring up the Bagelmeister. That is a bagel company down here in Douglasville, Georgia. I've been there many a times. As you can tell, I'm originally from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. I've missed a really good bagel, but I don't have to really worry about that anymore. Bagelmeister, they are from New York. They actually bring water down from New York and New Jersey to use in their bagels. And it's absolutely delicious, crisp. They have wonderful spreads, wonderful sandwiches. They're on Chapel Hill Road in Douglasville, Georgia. And if you can help out either by coming in to get a pickup or using something like Uber Eats, they're working so hard to keep their business going. Check them out. They're called the Bagelmeister.
Now, does the Bagelmeister ever get into squabbles with the bagel boss?
I mean, not really. I mean, like, Meister is so high above. There's, like, tiers between Meister and boss where it's, like, it'd be beneath him to talk directly to the bagel boss.
Gotcha. Well, the bagel boss is beneath a lot of people.
Yeah.
Just well, physically.
Tons of people.
So, yeah. And I will quickly promote. I promote them a few times. I like to keep it going. We are one of the places that puts our radio show out or our podcast out is Denville Radio. So if you're in New Jersey or if you're just on the internet in general, check us out. It's an independent radio station, so they're trying to always put programming out and whatnot. And there's a little mix-up. We weren't on there for maybe a couple weeks, but we are back, and we are in full swing, and all our episodes are on there. I'm looking at it right now. We got Jamie Lynn Watson, Toby Philpott, Coach Jim Johnson, Doug Kramer, Doug Clifford, and Kathy Tate. All those episodes are on right now. You can listen to there and give them a like over there at Denville Radio. So, guys, that is it. Please give us a follow on our social media, Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. And most of all, please just listen to the show and share it with your friends and leave us an old review on iTunes. That's it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
Later.